No consensus on the census today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. There may be a new ethnicity box on the 2020 census form. It's for people of Middle Eastern and North African descent. This woman is originally from Lebanon.
I have two children, and in our local school district, even though we check off other and put in Arab American, one of them is classified as white and one of them is classified as Asian.
But not everyone is so sure that the new census category is a good idea.
Donald Trump calls for a total and complete ban on Muslims entering the United States. Of course I'm going to think 10 times before I check that box.
Plus, some folks are really fed up with Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
We had enough of him. The campaign is called Basta, which means enough.
Also, we meet one of Pakistan's few female lawmakers. That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. So, to label or not to label, a good question to kick things off today. Makes sense to label some things, like food ingredients, but some people really don't like labeling themselves, like on the census form we're all asked to fill out every 10 years. You know those boxes you're supposed to check to identify your race or ethnicity? Right now, the U.S. Census Bureau is considering adding one more box to the mix, a category known by its acronym MENA. That'd be people who identify as Middle Eastern or North African. We've got two views on this. In a few minutes, we'll hear from someone who isn't sure this is a good idea.
Who's going to have access to that list? Is it going to be like the infamous no-fly list? Can someone get off that list? There are just so many questions going through my mind when I'm thinking about this topic.
But first, let's hear from Maya Berry, who thinks a new census box is a good idea. She's the executive director of the Arab American Institute.
There will be a category that is added called Middle Eastern North Africa. One would be able to check that box and then within that be able to specifically identify their country of origin or ethnicity. So, for example, I would check MENA. Being from Lebanon, I would also add Lebanese.
So let's say you're Iraqi. You could mark MENA and then specify Iraqi. Could you also mark white, like check white?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question because that's been one of the ways in which this category has been perhaps misunderstood or misreported on. The category itself is an ethnic reporting category. It is not a racial category. So within that, I could check white. I could check black. I'm a woman of color. I've never checked white ever on a census form. I've always checked out other and then filled out Arab American. So the issue of the racial piece would mean that I could check whatever I'd like with regards to race, but it just simply captures my ethnicity.
So if a lot of people from the Middle East and North Africa check this box, that would give the U.S. Census Bureau a better sense of how many people from that part of the world are now living in the United States. What benefits would that actually give them?
It's incredibly important. It's how we reapportion congressional districts. It's how we make determinations. The federal government does on the spending of our federal budget and the billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. When the Department of Education, for example, wants to make a determination on where they may need English as a second language program, it would be useful to know where there's a high concentration of newer immigrants from the Arab world who might need assistance with that. We're talking about data points. We're talking about policy. But the reality is this has real impact on people's lives.
I mean, it sounds like there are benefits, but there is some concern within communities that are Middle Eastern and North African that this could make it easier for federal agencies to surveil Arab households. It might place them on no-fly lists without their knowledge. Isn't that a fair concern, especially in the current political climate?
I completely understand those concerns. And I'll say this way. When the New York Police Department conducted its surveillance programs, frankly, spying programs on communities, they published what they called a community of interest program. And in the beginning of those reports, the first two pages where they cited how they conducted their surveillance of our community in New York, they used census data. This was after 9/11. And that was very disconcerting and very troubling. But my point to folks who have pushed back on this is that the value of arriving at a better category of our community far outweighs the risk, particularly with regards to government surveillance programs, because frankly, it's happened without the MENA category, and regrettably, I trust it'll continue to happen by some agencies. So that's the first point. The second point I would make is that, you know, the U.S. Census Bureau has been a very good partner in this process for us. They are aware of the concerns that exist. We will have to do our due diligence with massive outreach programs to explain to our communities what the benefits are of achieving a better count and addressing these particular concerns.
So this is still just a proposed change. A new census form would go to Congress for final approval in 2018 in time for the 2020 census. Despite some skepticism, just to be counted, what does that mean?
The question of finding yourself in the forum is an important one for a lot of us. I have two children, and in our local school district, even though we check off other and put in Arab American, one of them is classified as white and one of them is classified as Asian. And that's just sporadically how it ended up happening. I think part of it is just
You were born in Beirut, so does that change how your kids see themselves and answering this?
You know, they identify as Arab Americans, and one person tabulated the data one way, another person did it another way. So our ability to simply kind of identify the way we want to identify, I think, is important. And then I would go back to the very practical reasons. The census is used to allocate hundreds of billions of dollars of federal aid, and we want to make sure that local communities have the resources on the city, county, state, and federal level that they need. And I think that applies to everybody.
Maya Berry, Executive Director of the Arab American Institute. For another perspective on this, we turn to Ala Basatne. She was born in Syria, raised in Chicago, and now lives in Miami, where she's a human rights activist and a writer at Fusion. Basatne says if the Census Bureau does add a MENA box, she'd be conflicted about checking it. I asked her what she ticks now on similar forms.
I usually check Caucasian or white.
And what about most of your Arab friends?
Caucasian or white. It's just some do Asians, but majority of us feel like we're closer to Caucasian or white.
And you feel that way internally in your mind, or you're checking that box so you don't have to check or write in Middle Eastern or North African descent?
Absolutely. I'm checking that box because I want to blend in. There are just so many politicians, so many reasons that are labeling us as outsiders, and I want to be an insider.
Let me just clarify this. This is interesting because it sounds like you want to blend in kind of an assimilation kind of way, but you also want to be able to honor your own tradition and culture. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. I wear the headscarf. So on the street, people know that I am a Muslim Arab American, or at least a Muslim American. So when it comes to paperwork and things on the census, I'd rather be identified as white than risk being labeled under MENA and ending up on some kind of like hidden list that is like someone is like listening into my calls more than my Asian neighbor or my, you know, Latin American neighbor.
The Bureau estimated that there were 1.5 million households headed by people of Arab ancestry in 2013, but many analysts think the number might be closer to 5, even 8 million. Wouldn't it be useful to have a good estimate?
It would if we did not have politicians who are asking for Sharia tests and internment camps for Muslim Americans. We live in a very, very scary time. And it's unfortunate now when people or politicians actually say Syria on the news or on media, right away people think it's ISIS related or terrorist related. Unfortunately, there are many things that are written between the lines. Who's going to have access to that list? Is it going to be like the infamous no-fly list? Can someone get off that list? There are just so many questions going through my mind when I'm thinking about this topic.
You posted the other day that you were in an airport and you were thinking twice about, you had a magazine, about reading an article in that magazine. Just tell us about that moment.
I had a magazine that had an Arabic article in it, but then I thought to myself of all the stories that we've been hearing and reporting on recently of Arab Americans being kicked off planes just for saying inshallah, which means God willing, or saying anything that has to do with Arabic. So there's heightened fear, and therefore I did not open it and I did not read it because I didn't want the person sitting next to me to go say something, and therefore I would not end up on that plane.
The flip side to that is another incident that I'm hoping you'll recount, Ala. It's something that happened to you as you were walking down the street late at night. You just picked something up at the pharmacy. Take it from there.
Yes. So I was coming back from the pharmacy and this old lady in her car pulled up really close to me on the sidewalk. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, okay, she's going to say something horrible about my headscarf, or she's going to say one of the things that I usually hear down the street of Chicago and Miami. And all of a sudden she was smiling and she said, I only have one seat open in my car. I have my plants in the back. I would have loved to drop you both off. I was walking with my mom. She said, I would have loved to drop you both off, but I can't. So therefore, I'm just apologizing and tell you that I wanted to do this. I couldn't help myself but cry because I've never felt that connection with someone on the streets of Miami and Chicago.
She offered you a ride just like that.
She did.
These two incidents, I mean, it must make you kind of constantly think about different outcomes and how you just present yourself.
I'm always thinking about it before I do anything, even like before I honk the horn at someone that is driving in front of me. I think so many times, is this person going to look at me and see my headscarf and think, you know, I'm a rude person? Is this person going to label me? There are just so many things that I think about before I do anything in fear of being labeled or associated with the negative people we see on the media.
If you were totally free and not worried about consequences, Allah, what would you write down on a census form to describe yourself? If you had anything to write down, any label.
Arab American feminist.
Allah Basatne, great to speak with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Likewise.
Allah Basatne is a human rights activist and a writer at Fusion. If you're a guy at most universities in India, here's the drill. Study hard, prepare for a career, and study hard. If you're a woman, same deal, plus one other duty. Be back in your dorm every day by 6 p.m. and know the library doesn't count. Bhargavi Suresh studies at a university in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu. She started a campaign to protest the rules that many Indian universities apply only to women. It's not just the curfew. Female students also have a restrictive dress code. And Bhargavi says they can't leave campus.
In many colleges, you need to get special permission from your parents to go anywhere, to go outside college during the weekends and so on. And this permission is only given, you know, like very rarely. Your parents need to fax permission to the authorities. So it's this complicated process, which, of course, only impinges on women. So men usually don't have to go through all these processes.
What kind of impact does this have just on their scholastic performance?
So this is interesting because the college says this doesn't impact the students, and the students themselves have very divided views on this. And some of them say that it doesn't affect them, but they are restricted from, say, going to the library or taking part in certain projects that the guys can, for instance. So it definitely does have an impact, but it's not so widespread that the students are willing to stage a mass protest against it. So the responses are quite divided.
So it started, your campaign started with a Facebook post.
Yeah.
And now how would you describe your campaign? What are you doing?
All I did was write the post. And after that, all these wonderful women wrote to me, women who are fighting these rules every day. So there's this Delhi-based group called Pinjra Tod, which means break the locks. And they have been fighting unjust curfews in Delhi, India's capital, for a long time. And now they want to start in my state as well, in Tamil Nadu. So we're all figuring out how to move forward and what to do further about this. So, yeah, it's definitely a group effort.
What will be success for your campaign? How will you measure that?
Definitely for me, it's getting rid of discriminatory rules, you know, separate rules for girls and boys. But also, more than that, it's the entire cultural attitude which says that men and women should be kept separate. And yeah, there should be very little intermingling between the sexes. Hopefully it leads to a larger societal change instead of just a change in rules.
I mean, just on the curfew, 6 p.m. seems
like
a harsh curfew, but the general idea of curfews, I mean, we know the recent stories of Eve teasing and public harassment of women.
Right.
We know the story of Nirbhaya, the student who was gang raped and died in Delhi after she just went out to a night at the movies. Don't women need some form of protection and reminders of how nasty the streets are at night there?
Right. So that's the justification that's always used, right? Whenever we protest the curfews, they're like, what about the safety of women? Because things are quite bad, which, you know, point taken. But I think there are other measures that you can take to ensure safety of women apart from shutting them inside for, you know, 12 hours a day. I think that's a horrible measure. So our way forward is to now make these colleges realize how unfair they're being, how they're affecting the students, you know, mental health, because so many students spoke about being depressed and feeling caged and trapped and so on. So we want to say, listen, if you care about students' welfare at all, then you should probably not do this.
That was Bhargavi Suresh, who studies literature at university in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. You might not have noticed in the scrum that is this year's presidential election campaign, but there's one big issue that's virtually absent from the agenda, the climate crisis. Not a single question from the debate moderators and barely a mention from the candidates. But there is a lot at stake, and not just in the presidential race. The next Congress will play a big role, either supporting or blocking the agenda of whoever is in the White House, and campaign donors are paying attention. Vivica Novak is with the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, which tracks the influence of money in American politics. Vivica, what do you think is at stake in this election when it comes to climate and energy policy?
Well, the question is for the industry whether it will be able to stall the initiatives that were put forth by President Obama towards the end of his administration. Hillary Clinton is going to be much more in line with Obama's positions. Donald Trump would not be.
How are the two sides in this debate trying to influence a race between Trump and Clinton? And where is some of the big money coming from in support of each side?
Well, the oil and gas industry, of course, has a lot more money to play with than the renewable energy or alternative energy industry. So there are companies that give millions of dollars. Koch Industries, for instance, is number one in the industry in terms of campaign donations. And, you know, some of these groups, Koch Industries is interesting because it is not playing at the presidential level. The Kochs really don't like Donald Trump, so they're focusing their efforts on congressional races.
Yeah, where are those races happening? And is it also the Koch brothers who are bringing in money?
Well, the races, Katie McGinty and Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, very tight Senate race. Katie McGinty, of course, is a very strong environmentalist, very strong on climate change. Pat Toomey, much more favorable to the oil and gas industry. So that's where you're seeing a lot of contributions going. Toomey is one of the top recipients of oil and gas money. Katie McGinty, her number two contributor is the League of Conservation Voters.
So green money seems to be going in bigger than ever this year. Is it enough, though, to compete with industry money?
It'll never be enough to compete with oil and gas industry money.
You mentioned the race in Pennsylvania. There's also other pivotal races in New Hampshire, Nevada, North Carolina, possibly. In all these races, how does all this money seem to be affecting the outcome?
Well, the oil and gas industry has always been overwhelmingly Republican. In recent election cycles, not even making a pretense of trying to divide money evenly or hedge their bets. So they are contributing to the Republican candidate in all these tight races, trying to sway which way, you know, who controls Congress in the end. That is the ultimate game here.
Vivica Novak with the Center for Responsive Politics. We've been speaking with her by Skype from Washington. Vivica, thank you very much.
It's good to be with you.
So climate change is lurking in the background of this election. It's also lurking in the background of the future of the beer industry. True, that's because climate change is threatening hops, the key ingredient in the brewing process. But hop growers and brewers are fighting back. Here's our story from reporter Eilish O'Neill.
We all know that you need water to make beer. After all, beer's up to 95% water. But you also need water to grow the other stuff that's in beer, like barley and hops. Hops are the flowers of a kind of hemp plant. They're what give beer its aroma and flavor.
The brewers can't make beer without hops, so that's good for us.
Eric Demery is a fourth-generation hops grower in Washington's Yakima Valley, a high desert region just east of the Cascade Mountains. On his 1,100 acres, long rows of vines grow on trellises up to 20 feet high. A quarter of all the world's hops are grown around here, and they attract buyers from thousands of miles away.
The geography of the Yakima Valley is really unusual.
Ian Parks is with Purity Brewing in the UK. He says the far northern latitude bathes the region in long hours of summer sunlight, and melting snow from the Cascades provides water for most of the growing season. Together, those factors give the valley's hops their really distinct flavor.
The American hops just tend to give that pungency of aroma that you don't necessarily get from other hops.
But last year, Yakima Valley hop growers got a big scare.
I mean, it's just crazy. Like, nobody could believe that was happening.
What was happening in 2015, says climate scientist Guillaume Moget at the University of Washington, was a freakishly warm winter, 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. That meant the Cascades got rain all winter long and no snowpack formed. By May, the Yakima Valley was starved for water. Eric Demery managed to salvage his crop, but Moget says the warm winter was a harbinger of years to come.
You can sort of look at 2015 as kind of like a dress rehearsal for the future.
Moget says warm winters like 2015's will likely be the norm within about 50 years. Walking through one of Demery's hop yards, it's easy to see how a healthy snowpack is so crucial here. Only the vines are green. The surrounding hills are all brown, and the ground is dry and cracked. And this year was a good year for water.
Last year's drought scared a lot of people. So I think there's a renewed focus on trying to all of us get to a solution.
All of us means the different groups that have competed for water here for decades but are now trying to work together. But growers like Demaray aren't waiting to make changes.
Let's find the tube. There it is.
Demaray rustles around the base of a vine to find part of a plastic hose.
All the hop acreage now is drip irrigated, which allows us to be much more precise with the water.
Demaray has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on water conservation technology to get the most out of whatever nature will provide in a warmer future. But he's also hoping to help cut the risk of climate change by using a lot less energy, starting with his drying kilns. Hops are piled 3 to 4 feet high across a vast warehouse that smells, well, like beer. Drying those hops takes a ton of propane.
The propane in the burners below is enough to heat 440 homes.
But Demaray says it's 20% to 30% more efficient than his old kiln was. And nearby, he's got a newer one that's even better. Demaray is responding to his own local concerns, but he says he's also responding to the concerns of the people who buy his hops.
Every craft brewer now that we work with direct sends us a sustainability checklist that they want us to work on. And so we don't have to be 100% on everyone, but they want to see progress.
One of those brewers is Purity, Ian Park's outfit in Stratford-upon-Avon, England. Park says it's not just the quality of the hops that draws him to growers like Demaray.
We align with hop growers that have the same outlook as we do.
That outlook includes doing everything he can to make his business more climate friendly.
Brewing is a highly inefficient industry, and there was a lot of waste. What we set out to prove was that you can do things differently if there's a willingness to try.
Purity recycles all its wastewater on site. It recaptures some of its energy by reusing steam from its chimneys. It feeds its spent grain to cattle, and it uses the spent hops from Eric Demaray's farm back in Washington as fertilizer. Climate change can often seem like a pretty abstract problem, but Park says the threat to his hop supplier in the U.S. makes it very real.
It really galvanizes our efforts to try and be more sustainable here.
Millions of beer drinkers, especially those who like hoppy IPAs, might hope those and other such efforts succeed. But for his part, UW climate scientist Guillaume Moget has one other suggestion for taking the pressure off hops growers.
Make less IPA. I'm not an IPA fan.
For The World, Alicia O'Neill, Seattle.
I'm Marco Werman. One of Pakistan's few women lawmakers fights for victims of acid attacks.
During my activism, I saw some victims in hospitals, and I promised them on their deathbed that I would get them legislation so that they would get justice.
The latest story in our series on women, American money, and Pakistan, hashtag balance of power. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're about to introduce you to one tough politician. She's been knocked down countless times and gotten back up, and she's focused her political power on helping women and children. Might sound familiar, but this politician is not in Washington. She's a member of parliament in Islamabad. The World's Carolyn Beeler traveled to Pakistan for our Balance of Power series, which looks at the impact U.S. foreign policy has on women around the globe. And that's precisely the reason why Carolyn ended up speaking with an influential Pakistani parliamentarian.
At a dimly lit welfare center outside of Islamabad, women press their thumbs against a scanner to get their new biometric IDs for welfare payments. The women here are among the 5.3 million in Pakistan who get small cash payments through the country's biggest social safety net. Akhtar Shaheen is a 40-year-old mother of five. She says she uses the money for asthma medicine and school fees for her kids. The program pays women only, and that's by design.
They are treated as heads of household. The money is going to them.
That's the program's head, Marvi Memon. Don't be fooled by her soft voice. She's laser-focused. She never drops eye contact. And frankly, she's pretty intimidating. She says the welfare program she runs is not just about money. It's about raising the status of women, even in their own families.
So when you're treating women as primary members of the household, then their importance in that family kind of increases immediately, and their their status improves.
Memon knows what it is to have your status improved. She's the daughter of a powerful politician, and she's a member of parliament in her own right. But she wasn't elected. She was selected by her party for a seat reserved especially for women. She's among a wave of women lawmakers to take office since 2002. That's when Pakistan adopted a quota mandating that parliament has to be 17% women. She says she's been fighting for the rights of women ever since. Her best-known legislation is a 2011 law that established stiff penalties for perpetrators of acid attacks.
We were able to garner support from all women across all parties. So I'm very grateful to the women in those days who came together on this particular issue.
Women make up just 1 in 5 parliamentarians around the world. And quotas like Pakistan's are a way to get more women, like Memon, in the door. But
what we see is that quotas are usually not enough in order to really have the female parliamentarians have an impact.
That's Alexandra Rosen from the Brussels-based advocacy group Women in Parliaments.
We do know that there are a few strategies that have proven successful in terms of female MPs maximizing their power in parliaments. And the first one is networks.
Rosen says women often can't break into the old boys clubs that help male politicians drum up support for their bills. So new groups can help women. Her foundation is building a network of the world's roughly 9,000 female parliamentarians.
To create this kind of new girls network to rival those traditional routes to power.
In Pakistan, a kind of new girls network has been given a lot of credit for empowering female legislators. The UN helped start a women's parliamentary caucus in 2008. And shortly after that, Parliament passed legislation on domestic violence, workplace harassment, and legal assistance for women prisoners. It's especially hard for women lawmakers to buck the party here in Pakistan because most are appointed by party leadership. But the head of the Women's Caucus, Shaista Pervez, says the caucus is the one place women's issues trump party politics.
This platform is one platform where all party women get together. We try to build consensus, and it's across party. Nobody belongs to any party when it comes on the caucus floor.
But this is politics, where no one ever agrees.
I did not find the caucus effective at all.
Marvi Memon says she got work done not by rallying her sisterhood, but by sitting at the same table as men.
I had to use Parliament's main floor, and then the Supreme Court, and then the streets of Pakistan.
Memon's a political fighter, and she doesn't buy the idea that networking is a key to elevating women. She thinks getting hardworking female lawmakers into Parliament has been the most important step in pushing against the patriarchy. In that way, she says the quota system has worked.
This crutch that I call a crutch has actually served. Whilst it is a crutch, it is a useful crutch.
A crutch that's landed her in a corner office behind a big desk, expanding a billion-dollar program to help more women, while her male secretary brings her tea. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The World, Islamabad.
Carolyn's story from Pakistan is part of our Balance of Power series, which, as I mentioned earlier, looks at how U.S. foreign policy impacts women around the globe. There's no better place to explore that than Afghanistan. The U.S. has spent more on women in Afghanistan than in any other country in the world, $1.5 billion since 2001, according to reporter Amy Ferris-Rotman. She's with the Wall Street Journal, but previously in Afghanistan, she founded Sahar Speaks. That's an organization that mentors women, journalists there. Amy, an analysis you co-wrote recently says that despite all the U.S. government spending on programs for women in Afghanistan and a decade of U.S. presence there, the reality faced by women in Afghanistan has barely changed. So let's start with that obvious question. What has that money gone to?
This is the million-dollar question, and I think the money was not spent in the way it was meant to be spent, in the sense that a lot of it may have reached some women, it may have reached some female programs, empowerment programs. However, the main issue is there wasn't really a very good thorough checking to actually see and monitor the work that has been going on in Afghanistan. So that's one problem. Another problem is the money did also disappear into the pockets of people on the ground because of corruption, but also because of poorly managed projects.
We speak about, you know, basic human rights for women. I mean, is it realistic to think the U.S. can intervene to prevent violence against women and girls in a place like Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, is it realistic? I think it's realistic that a rich country can try and help the situation on the ground for women and children. I do think, yes, the US could have done a much better job than they did, and they had the resources to do it. I don't want to poo-poo all the programs that have been happening in Afghanistan. Of course, there has been some change as well, positive change. A lot of money has been spent in Afghanistan on business programs, empowering women to run businesses, empowering women to be able to become managers. And the reality on the ground is very different. Afghan women are generally not interested in becoming managers, not interested, you know, in how we can do a master's degree in business. We're interested in much more basic things, which is how I'll be able to walk down the street unharassed and how I'll be able to protect myself from violence because the rule of law in Afghanistan does not protect them. This was, for some bizarre reason, overlooked.
Could they have done a better job if they weren't thinking about turning women into kind of business managers?
Absolutely. I think that they didn't really understand from the get-go what they were really meant to be doing in Afghanistan, the US, I mean, in terms of improving the lives of women. You know, improving the lives of Afghan women became this sort of litmus test for major nations getting involved in Afghanistan. George Bush essentially said it was one of the main reasons that the US invaded Afghanistan, overthrew the Taliban. Yet things were not being done properly on the ground. In terms of violence against women, the US should have made this more serious in their dealings with the Afghan government. They failed to do this. Other governments did manage to do it. Only very small countries such as Norway, they actually threatened the Afghan government and said, if you do not change the situation on the ground to do with violence against women, we will withhold our aid. The United States never did that.
So are women still in Afghanistan kind of an afterthought? I mean, the cynics would look at this and say, wow, it was a huge talking point. George W. and Laura Bush were talking about it. Jay Leno's wife got him talking about Afghan women on his show. I mean, the cynics would say that, hey, after the Taliban, any money would look great helping women.
I think that is kind of the thinking that people were going on. They were thinking, we're throwing money around. Doesn't really matter if we monitor it. Doesn't really matter if we check what happens to it. We're sending it there and only good can come out of that. And of course, that proved to be a disaster. I mean, there are parts of Afghanistan where women say they live exactly the same as they did under the Taliban.
So bottom line, Amy, $1.5 billion over a decade in Afghanistan, well spent or not very well spent?
I always think it's better to spend and to try change the situation than to do nothing. There are some success stories. We can't deny that. There has been a better situation for women in urban centers. There are better literacy rates. Healthcare has become better. Again, we're talking about urban areas. In terms of the countryside, women's lives are practically unchanged, if anything, more violent than they were before. However, I do think that the United States shouldn't have done or entered Afghanistan in the way they did with the approach they had for gender. It was a lot of money misspent, and Afghan women still have a long, long road to go on before they can talk about really improved rights.
Wall Street Journal correspondent Amy Ferris-Rotman speaking with us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And you can read a reflection on life in Afghanistan since the U.S. invasion from a woman who grew up in the midst of it. That's at PRI.org. Less than 2 weeks to go to the presidential election, and it seems there's no hiding from Hillary Clinton's emails and Donald Trump's misogynist comments. Those controversies will be part of the campaign to the bitter end. But here's something new to talk about, a comment by Trump that Clinton's Syria policy would, quote, start World War III. Trump's own policy on Syria isn't exactly clear, and whatever it is, it would be clouded by confusion over his attitude toward Russia, a partner of Syria's in the war there. The World's Richard Hall is following all of this from his base in Beirut, and I asked him what Hillary Clinton is proposing for Syria that Donald Trump thinks will start World War III.
Hillary is basically advocating a much more interventionist policy to Barack Obama's. She wants a no-fly zone to protect civilians. She also wants to provide greater support, material support, in the form of weapons and money to rebel groups on the ground that are fighting Assad and also fighting ISIS. She wants greater support for the Kurds fighting ISIS. She also wants to take in more refugees to the United States.
So start with a no-fly zone. What does it actually mean, and who would enforce the no-fly zone that she's proposing?
Interesting thing. No-fly zone is kind of a very broad term. I think Clinton has evolved on this since her time as Secretary of State. No-fly zone originally, I think, meant to ground Assad's air force and make sure that Assad planes couldn't bomb any areas in northern Syria. Now, since Russia has become involved in the conflict, that becomes a lot more complicated. Now, not only do they have to ground Assad planes, they may also have to potentially shoot down Russian jets. And that's where the World War III comments come in from Donald Trump.
I mean, it's a scary thought and all the possible consequences that could kind of unfold after shooting down a Russian warplane. But what is Donald Trump proposing instead?
The thing about Donald Trump's policy on Syria is that it's very, very short. If you go onto his website, you can see his positions, and they mostly say the same thing. The idea, as far as Donald Trump is concerned, is to defeat ISIS, and everything else takes a second place to that. So he wants to defeat ISIS and basically leave Assad in power. His argument is that if you target Assad, ISIS will take over in his place, which is probably not very accurate, but that's his position.
Why does Trump feel that way? Is there some Russia influence coming into this? Because that's the way Russia feels. They want Assad to stay in power, at least for the time being.
He certainly shares the position of Russia when it comes to Syria in that regard. Russia also says, you know, the rebels, the people that would take over from Assad are worse than Assad. They are terrorists. They are head choppers, that kind of thing. Donald Trump seems to agree with that position. And I think that basically comes down to not knowing very much about the Syrian opposition. People that follow Syria closely know that the Syrian opposition is very varied. It goes from moderate to very extreme. And there's kind of a great variance of rebel groups in the Syrian conflict. Donald Trump sees them all as one group.
What is Hillary Clinton's position on President Assad? Keep him for the time being and then we'll deal with him?
I think that the overall aim of Hillary Clinton is not to overthrow him as such, but give his opponents enough support and enough weapons so that Assad is forced to the negotiation table. Everyone agrees that the only way this war will stop is by the opposing sides negotiating. No one is under any illusions that they can completely overthrow Assad and the rebels will storm into Damascus and take power. What they want to do is balance the power on the ground so much so that Assad is forced to negotiate. And at the moment, Assad is winning. He has the support of a military superpower in the form of Russia, and he doesn't feel the need to negotiate. So advocates of greater support for the rebels want to force him to negotiate.
So what does the smart money in Beirut say about all of Hillary Clinton's policies on Syria? Like diplomats, do they expect her to actually try and push these ideas through, you know, kind of one stepping stone after another, getting the balance of power on the ground and then off to the next step, pushing Assad from power?
It's very divided, actually, here as much as it is in the U.S. There are significant problems with enforcing a no-fly zone, not least Russia deploying ground-to-air missile defense systems in Syria that could shoot down planes and create a conflict with Russia. What I think people are expecting from Clinton is a slightly moderated version of what she's proposing. I think she will probably increase support to Syrian rebels on the ground, push the no-fly zone aside, and, as I say, try to force Assad to negotiate, try to force him to the negotiation table. She also talks about the possibility of a negotiated no-fly zone. This is kind of an interesting concept. She wants to come to an agreement with Russia to enforce a no-fly zone in northern Syria, one that would have Russia's agreement. Now, the likelihood of that happening is probably quite small.
The World's Richard Hall in Beirut. Thanks for walking us through this.
Thanks very much.
Here's a story we're going to have for you tomorrow. In the Bay Area, three cities will be voting on ballot proposals that would tax soda and other sugary drinks. Supporters say it would help reduce rates of obesity and diabetes, especially in low-income communities. But those opposed say it's not a soda tax, it's a grocery tax. And they produce TV ads featuring owners of a halal butcher shop, an Asian market, a Latino food mart.
There's nobody who is white. And it's all targeted towards people of color in low-income communities. And so it's kind of like, why are they doing this?
Immigrant communities on the front lines of the soda tax debate. That story is coming up here tomorrow. And still to come today, remembering one of Brazil's 1970 soccer heroes right here on The World. Joe Arpaio thinks of himself as the toughest sheriff in America. He's the sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, which includes Phoenix. And Arpaio's built a career on his hardline stance on illegal immigration. Now the six-term sheriff is facing the toughest re-election ever and a grassroots effort to push him out of office. Jude Joffe Block of station KJZZ in Phoenix has our story.
I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom.
We're at the kickoff for the biggest canvassing effort to date against Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He's been in office for 23 years. About 500 volunteers will knock on doors. Their campaign is called Basta Arpaio.
We had enough of him. The campaign is called Basta, which means enough.
Abril Gallardo is helping organize the campaign, which has gone national. Arpaio isn't just a local sheriff. He's earned friends and foes across the U.S. for his ties to Republican nominee Donald Trump and his push against illegal immigration here with sweeps and worksite raids. So people are traveling from all over to support the anti-Arpaio campaign.
There are buses who came from New Mexico, buses who came from L.A. We have people from New York, from Atlanta.
Rene Martinez came from California. The union he works for sent him here to help defeat Arpaio.
We've heard basically about the profiling. We've heard about, you know, sheriff's department stopping people. It was just based on how they look.
3 years ago, a federal judge found Arpaio's immigration enforcement tactics racially profiled Latinos. Now the sheriff faces criminal contempt of court charges for disobeying the judge in that case and continuing to make immigration arrests after he was ordered to stop. All of this motivates his opponents. Many are immigrants themselves. Before everyone leaves to knock on doors, speakers fire them up.
Joe Arpaio is done. He's already lost. He's on his way down. What our opportunity is to be the ones to knock him out.
I follow three women to the Phoenix suburb of Chandler to knock on doors.
Oh, Angel. Hi. My name is Vanessa. I work with the Basta Arpaio campaign.
On their list, minority or millennial voters registered to vote but who might need an extra nudge. The canvassers don't actively promote Arpaio's opponent, a Democrat named Paul Pinzon. Instead, they pass out anti-Arpaio literature with a cartoon of him with Trump and a line through them both.
Buenos dias.
Rosa Renteria is one of the volunteers. She's from Mexico, lives in Phoenix without papers, and has feared Arpaio for years. She can't vote, but wants to make sure those who have the right use it. She also jokes about Arizona's former governor, Jan Brewer, who recently said Latinos wouldn't help Democrats here because they don't vote.
Les puso el dedo en la llaguita. Ojalá que les haya servido.
Renteria says Brewer hit a sore spot. Let's hope it helps, she says, and compels Latinos to vote. Down the street, we meet a Latina voter who says she's already mailed in her vote against Arpaio.
Just because he's against the immigrants and deporting people and innocent people and, you know, people that just want to be here and work and have a better life.
A recent poll shows Arpaio trailing by 15 points. But Chad Willems, Arpaio's campaign manager, says his polls show Arpaio ahead. He's not worried about the Basta Arpaio campaign.
It's really telling that, you know, they had to bring in people from out of state. They don't have any organic grassroots support here for the people that vote here, that live here.
Arpaio has benefited from out-of-state campaign donations, raising $12 million. It's meant lots of TV ads. One highlights his outdoor jail, another his work protecting animals, another accuses the Justice Department of unfairly charging him with criminal contempt right before the election. Willem says the message is working.
Our fundraising has picked up immensely. The number of volunteers we have out knocking on doors and making phone calls has more than doubled.
At the end of the day, the Basta Arpaio crew gathers in front of Arpaio's office to throw him what they've dubbed a retirement party. At one point, we catch a glimpse of Arpaio through a window in his building. His opponents start chanting. Going down, Arpaio's going down, they chant. On November 8th, they'll find out if county voters agree. For the world, Jude Jaffe Block, Phoenix.
Finally today, let me take you back to a historic soccer game, the 1970 World Cup final in Mexico City, Brazil versus Italy. By then, Brazilians knew about their national team's beautiful game, but it was at that 1970 match that the Brazilians' reputation was sealed globally. You could see the effortlessness with that final goal scored by Carlos Alberto, a defender. If the Italians were struggling to get the ball back from the Brazil side, the Brazilians seemed not to notice. Four easy fakes, a bunch of sweet passes, almost leisurely plays down the field, and then about 10 feet out of the penalty area, the great Pelé softly kicks it forward and out to a charging Carlos Alberto.
Up comes Carlos Alberto on the right, and it's goal!
Carlos Alberto with a final goal for Brazil and the championship that year. The man Brazilians affectionately refer to as Capitão, or Captain, died of a heart attack, 72. Flags today in Brazil are at half-mast. It kind of gives you an idea as to how much people love him. The AP's Mauricio Savarese is in that group. Why is the death of Carlos Alberto such a loss for Brazil?
Carlos Alberto is a reference to the beautiful game, and it's also a reference of leadership. So when people talk about Brazilian football and what made Brazilian football become a global brand, they think of the 1970 World Cup winning team, and Carlos Alberto was one of the most important players in that team.
I mean, Pelé was a key part of that team and kind of became the global brand for Brazilian soccer. Was there something about Carlos Alberto, though, that Brazilians understood that the rest of us did not?
Well, Carlos Alberto is an innovative player because he was one of the first players, one of the first defenders to go box to box. So that go against Italy, the one in the final,
yeah.
He remembered the team that if they managed to drag the Italian defenders to the left, there would be a gap on the right. And he said that when he saw Clodoaldo dribbling through the Italian midfield and passing it to the left, and the Italian defense moving to the left, he already started sprinting because he knew that gap would be open and he would be able to have a fair finish.
I mean, he really watched the play on the pitch and strategized like a chess player. We'll have that final Carlos Alberto goal from the Italy match in 1970 on our Facebook page. How will you remember him, Mauricio? How will you remember Carlos Alberto?
Well, Carlos Alberto is one of the biggest symbols of Brazilian football, not only because he was leading the best team ever to wear the yellow shirt, but also because he was a reference off the pitch. He was also someone that showed Brazil that we had to go to basics sometimes instead of just winning World Cups and winning matches without any style. Now Brazil seems to have a little more interest in that. He's a does-it-all in football. He was important on the pitch and important off the pitch as well. And that's a big void that is very unlikely to be filled anytime soon.
The AP's Mauricio Savarese in Rio de Janeiro remembering for us the late great soccer star Carlos Alberto. Thanks so much for your time, Mauricio.
Thanks for having me.
We leave it there today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.